In our continuing mission to understand how ISIS, the so-called Islamic State, manages to govern, hold territory, and fund its operations, we focus on how ISIS has created a kind of currency in captured women. A few weeks ago, a terrifying Frontline documentary showed us how women from the Yazidi minority in Iraq are captured, auctioned off, and in some cases, rescued by a heroic group of lawyers and activists. Today, a look at how this system of sex slavery works and the impact it has had on thousands of young women. ISIS has implemented a deeply rooted and developed infrastructure of sex slavery involving the females in the religious minority of the Yazidis. And community leaders estimate that more than 3,000 Yazidis are still being held captive by the group. Rukmini Kalamaki is foreign correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. She's conducted interviews with 21 women and girls who recently escaped from the throes of the Islamic State as part of her recent reporting. Rukmini, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, John.
We use the term infrastructure. How does that look to you from your perspective?
Yes, one of the surprising things that I learned here in Iraq when I was interviewing these women is that ISIS has essentially created a bureaucracy of slavery. Women who are taken captive are bought and sold by fighters. At the moment of the purchase, there's a contract, and the contract is in fact notarized by an Islamic State-run court. Then further to that, when a woman is freed, and there have been some that have actually been freed by ISIS fighters themselves, they are given what they call an emancipation certificate. It really reminds you of what we used to see, you know, in America in the 1800s in the South, where a person could become a freed slave and would essentially have a document stating that.
But as someone carrying around an emancipation certificate, I can't imagine one can then rejoin normal life in any significant way.
I spoke to one woman who was freed by her Libyan slave master. And the reason she was freed is he was a suicide bomber. He was about to go and blow himself up. And there is Islamic scripture that states that it is virtuous to free a slave. So knowing that he was about to die, he gave her the certificate. It did allow her to cross all of the checkpoints from very deep inside rural Syria all the way back to Iraq. However, the last checkpoint, which would have taken her to safety, is one that she would not have been able to cross. But at least from there, she had enough freedom of movement and she was able to go to a shop, buy herself a phone, call her family, and they then paid for a smuggler to get her the rest of the way to safety.
Aside from the deep emotional scarring from something like this that we'll talk about in a moment, do women with emancipation certificates have an ability to start a family, to be viewed as potential mates in the same way that other women who had not had this slave experience would be?
The certificate that she had stated in Arabic that she now has the status of a Muslim woman with all of the duties and responsibilities that come with that status under Sharia law. So obviously she now can behave as a Muslim woman under ISIS's, you know, definition of that, which is still a very restrictive status. She is able to marry a man who is then allowed to marry at least three other women, and he is also allowed to have Yazidi sex slaves. So what we're seeing is the very few women that have been given this emancipation certificate, they're not hanging around, you know, to see what life in
exactly
the caliphate is really like. You know, they're using that as a way to get out of Dodge.
All right. Well, that's bizarre enough right there. It sounds as though the ISIS military is using this sex slavery infrastructure as a way of enforcing a kind of morale booster for fighters, a way of supporting them, a sort of benefits program. I don't quite understand.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's really sick about it. Several of the women told me that, you know, they would be present when their owner would be having phone conversations with other fighters who they gathered from the tone of the conversation were not in country. They were abroad. And the gist of the conversation was, you come to the caliphate, you can have women for cheap, you can buy beautiful women from this Yazidi ethnic group. And I think that's particularly appealing to men, for example, from Gulf countries, who come from a very conservative society where dating is taboo and where casual sex is essentially forbidden, and where marriage is also off bounds to people who don't have a lot of means. Because in order to marry, you have to be able to, you know, pay a dowry, provide for your family, buy, you know, have a house. And so within those strictures, you can see how this system, where you can come and essentially buy a poor girl for very little would be a bonus.
Enough about the system. The women that you interviewed, how are they feeling? What is their state of mind? What do you think is the long-term consequence of this terrible experience?
You know, I have to say, John, it's been a really long time since I've done interviews that have been this dark. It's absolutely crushing what has happened to them. They were treated like, you know, I don't even want to say animals. Animals are not treated this way. They were treated like nothing. And the fact that they were, the fact that there is a theological justification for what was done to them is, I think, what they and I, you know, find most disturbing about this. They were told over and over again, what we are doing to you is halal. What we are doing to you is allowed, and it's not just allowed, but it is seen as virtuous and good in the eyes of God.
Finally, do these, you know, morbidly creative folks at ISIS have a name for this infrastructure?
Well, they're using an entire lexicon around it, and they're using very old words. Sabia is an archaic word that means slave. And the women talk about how they were grabbed on the mountain, on Sinjar Mountain, as they were trying to flee last August 3rd. And immediately, the women and the men were separated from each other. And very soon after, older women and young women are also cleaved and separated. They brought fleets of buses with them. So the women realized right away that these people were planning to transport them somewhere. And they were then taken to essentially a set of holding pens in Iraq, especially in the city of Mosul. And very soon after, ISIS officials came in, and they began hearing the word Sabia. Sabaya is the plural of it. And these were words that even though these young women are Arabic speakers, they didn't know. And they all describe this moment, this chilling moment, this really horrifying moment when they finally realize what this word means, that it means slave, and that they have become enslaved.
Rukmini Kalamaki, foreign correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much.
John, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.